You're listening to the Environment and Conservation Show on UK Health Radio. Hello, thank you so much for tuning in. My name is Yara. You're listening to the Environment and Conservation Show on UK Health Radio. Today's interview is going to be with Richard Schiffman, who is an environmental journalist, poet, and author of two books. He's written for platforms like the Washington Post, the New York Times, and he's even interviewed some of my favorite people, like scientist Suzanne Simard and conservationist Jane Goodall. You can connect with Richard via his website, which is richschiff.contently.com. So I hope you enjoy today's interview with Richard Schiffman, and I'll be speaking with Richard in New York.
'Cause when you stop to think what nature's given, don't you think it might be time to give some back?
Hello, Richard. Thank you so much for joining me on the Environment and Conservation Show on UK Health Radio. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks, Yara. Thanks for talking to me. I'm here in New York City and you're in London. And thanks to the miracle of Zoom, we're able to communicate. This has been a great tool for me as an environmental journalist, too, to speak with people all over the world on Zoom. I think it's really terrific.
Exactly, Richard. They're tools, aren't they? And it's like how we use these tools for positive or negative. And we can use these tools to connect with each other for sure. So would you like to please introduce yourself to the listeners and share a little bit about your background and what you're working on at the moment, environmental journalism wise, please?
Well, as you say, I'm a journalist by profession. I actually started in radio, as you have, and I know you've also done some print journalism, but I actually did a call-in show on a public radio station in New York City when I was in high school, and it was mostly about education and, you know, sort of things that would be of interest to teenagers, but also public affairs. I mean, we interviewed the mayor of New York, and so that gave me a taste for journalism, and I actually did not go into it right away. After I graduated from college, I was so drawn to world cultures. I was an anthropology major, but I was especially drawn to India since I was, you know, basically a teenager. I read the Bhagavad Gita, which is kind of the Hindu scripture, when I was 12 years old. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. And I read Autobiography of a Yogi, which made me think, I don't know if you how many of your listeners have read that, but it's kind of a classic text written by Paramahamsa Yogananda about his travels through India and spiritual adventures in India. And reading that made me really feel I wanted to go to India after college. So I did. After graduating from college, I went overland to India and enjoyed the wonderful natural world, especially in the Himalayas, which for me was a revelation of another world. The peaks just, they're unlike anything even in the U.S. And I've been to the Rocky Mountains and to the Sierras in California, but there's something about the Himalayas that's, I mean, the only word that I can use is transcendent. It takes you beyond the earth just to look at them. These sheer walls of rock and ice just rising 20, 25,000 feet into the sky. And the way the clouds would move in and out, especially at sunset, and you'd see like one peak would be revealed in this otherworldly light, and then it would disappear, and yet another peak in the distance would come out. I mean, it was just, for me, it was, I would say, one of the high points of my life to walk through the Himalayas literally weeks at a time without a guide, without even a proper map in some cases, and without knowing Nepali or Hindi. Somehow I made it to the you know, above the base camp of Mount Everest and several other beautiful places in the Himalayas. So that was part of, you know, my kind of love of nature, which is what eventually brought me into environmental journalism. So after I came back from India, I was thinking, well, what can I do professionally? And I thought, well, I like journalism. And I started by doing radio journalism, mostly on the environment for National Public Radio. But the short pieces that I was doing for NPR were a little unsatisfying. They were kind of like you could just get the headlines and not go into too much depth. And I guess I've always, as a journalist, wanted to talk a little bit more about the human heart and not just statistics and crises that we're going through. I wanted to sort of bring the heart, emotion, and spirit into my work. And so I gradually, moved toward print journalism, where I've written mostly for places like the New York Times, Scientific American, The Atlantic. And since I have this love since being a child of the natural world, it was just natural to go into environmental journalism. Although in a way, even just to talk about it as the environment or something is a bit artificial, because it's like, we are the environment. We're part of this. It's only the earth. And we're all here together. We're all in the same boat together. Yeah. So I've been doing that work. And I know I've interviewed some of your favorite people. So
that's right, Richard. You have. I know you've interviewed Jane Goodall and Suzanne Simard, especially with Suzanne Simard, because she's the forest ecologist who proved scientifically the whole tree and fungal communication, which is quite recent, I believe, in the last like 3 years or something. That's just, spreading to the world. I feel Indigenous people have been sharing these messages for a very long time, but, we tend to wait until science declares it. What did you take away from that interview, Richard, with Suzanne Simard?
Well, yeah, I mean, she's an amazing scientist because she really combines, but both Jane Goodall and Suzanne Simard combine the heart and the head, which I think is so important in our world. Science can be totally intellectual and a little bit dry and not really supportive of the kind of values of the living world that we believe in. And Suzanne Simard is absolutely not that type of scientist. I mean, she, from the very beginning, she felt the interconnectedness of things in the forest. And she couldn't believe that each tree, each shrub, each, bush, everything is just separate. It didn't feel to her that was accurate. So she began studying what happens underneath the ground. And it's just fascinating because, yes, on the surface, you have a tree here and a tree there, and they seem to be separate. But under the ground, there are the mycelial networks, which means mycelium are mushrooms, but it's the larger body of the mushroom. It's not above the ground. It's underground in these thread-like networks. And what's happening underground is that the trees have connections to other trees, including other trees of other species, which really amazed me in my discussion with Suzanne, is that trees will feed when they're producing too much sugar. All green vegetation produces sugar through photosynthesis to feed itself. But lo and behold, these trees in the Pacific Northwest that she was studying are not just feeding themselves, they're also feeding other trees. And what I found so fascinating is that the fir trees and the birch trees are connected in these networks underground. And the birch trees in the summer, the birch trees have leaves and they're producing their own sugar. They don't need any extra sugar. In fact, they have too much. And so during the summer, the birch trees send some of those sugars to the fir trees, which are not producing that much sugar at that time. And in the winter, it's reversed because in the winter, so the birch trees have lost all their leaves and the fir trees still have their needles and the fir trees have more than they can use. So they sent some of it to the birch. So I found this so amazing. And in a way, I mean, you could say it's like superior to human beings, right? I mean, in human society, we're not that generous necessarily. We think about our family or our country, but it's not like this kind of sharing network, I think, is something we can learn from trees. And so that was just a delight to speak to her. I interviewed her for Scientific American. If anyone wants to find it, if you look Suzanne Simard, Scientific American, you could find that interview. And she's written a recent book about not just about her scientific research, but about her growing up and how the science was part of her life, a natural extension of what she was already interested in and pursuing. So quite a good book that I'd recommend.
That's just it, Richard. I feel like in many concrete jungles that we're growing up in these days, there's a bit of a separation from the land. That whole consciousness, that spirituality, I feel it comes with the connection to the natural world. I mean, you said it, humans are nature. And a wise man once said, like, what we do to nature, we're doing to ourselves. So it's about bridging that gap that humans over the years, that separation that has come about. But I feel like now times are changing. Like, didn't you find, Richard, that during lockdown, people naturally gravitated towards the natural world for their own personal healing?
Yeah, it's interesting. Here in New York City, when people couldn't meet, they couldn't go to concerts or movie theaters, the types of things that city people love to do. The parks were crowded, even in the middle of the winter. People just thronged to the parks because it was the only thing that they can do. And it's still true that the parks have been more used in the last, you know, year and a half than ever before. And also another thing that I know, so I don't know if this happened in London, but, you know, New York has dealt to some extent with its pollution. It's no longer, the air quality is better than it used to be, for sure. But at the beginning of the pandemic, when there were no air flights and people weren't even getting in their cars very much, it's like the air was noticeably better. And I never would have known that New York's air is still not so great, except for the fact that during the pandemic, all of a sudden, the air smelled like in the woods. And that was sort of like a revelation to me. It's, oh, my God, you know, if we just stop doing some of the things that we usually do for a few days, all of a sudden the air quality improves tremendously. So that was
interesting. And I'd heard as well that the Himalayan mountains were visible for the first time in many years from Chandigarh, from a distance, because the air quality had cleared up when we'd stopped. Now, I mean, as an environmental journalist, Richard, I would imagine that you hear a lot of, you know, depressing stuff on the environment, but let's keep things positive. Like, what positive environmental initiatives have you encountered going on around the world? Because we don't normally hear about them too often on the mainstream media.
Well, I think there's a number of things that I've written about and participated in. I mean, one very positive thing, I think it's so important that young people especially develop a connection to nature. And I think it's really challenging today because, for one thing, the pandemic, but also just the amount of time that all of us are spending on screens, and especially the young. And I feel that it's so important in terms of the environment. If we're going to save it, right, we're going to have to love it. And if we don't know it, we're not going to love it. And so I've been involved. One of the best jobs I think I've ever had was actually before the print journalism. I worked as an outdoor education teacher, and we would get a different sixth grade class from, I worked in two different places, one outside of Boston and the other outside of Los Angeles. And in both cases, we were in beautiful natural environments outside of the city, and we would get a class of sixth graders, and they would spend the week with us, and I would take them around on hikes and teach them basic ecology. And it was an amazing experience for me. I mean, it was an amazing experience for them, for sure, because in many cases, they'd never been away from the city. I mean, I remember once taking one group in the mountains outside of Los Angeles. So Los Angeles is one of the largest sprawled cities in North America. It's not, New York's like fairly compact, whereas Los Angeles is just this huge basin. And if you live anywhere in the Los Angeles basin, you can't see the sky at night. You know, the lights just don't allow you to see the stars. So I had these kids take a night walk, and one kid came up to me and said, "Geez, Mr. Richard, it's just like the planetarium." You know, and I thought, oh my God, you know, this kid has never seen the stars, but they've seen the planetarium. So they know stars from the planetarium. Well, that was an eye opener, but also it was like, it's kind of tragic, isn't it? That young people in cities are growing out without contact with nature. So both of these programs I thought were just amazing and terrific and so important, because I feel, as I said before, it's like if you don't know the natural world, you're not going to protect it. And I think it's so important, even for environmental activists, as I know you are, and many of the people who are listening today, I'm sure, are active on the environment. But, you know, I've talked to many environmental activists who get burned out after a while with just, you know, kind of political work or organizing and demonstrations. And I think it's so important for all of us to get back into nature, to refuel, just to replenish our own inspiration and energy, and mainly our own love of nature, because I think that has to drive our environmental activism or our environmental journalism, for that matter. You know, it has to come out of that deep sense of love and connection.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
How good are vitamin C supplements? Usually only a small proportion of vitamin C actually reaches your cells and has a positive effect. Whereas the high absorption levels of Goldman Laboratories' liposomal vitamin C help maintain optimal vitamin C levels in your body and strengthen your immune system. Now get 10% off when you choose Goldman Laboratories' liposomal vitamin C capsules. Just quote 10 off at goldmanlaboratories.com.
Do you suffer from pain? B-Cure Laser, a home-use CE-approved medical device for the effective treatment of pain, is now available in the UK. The results of a double-blind trial has shown that B-Cure Laser offers a significant reduction in pain compared to the placebo group. To get your special B-Cure offer now, call free on 0808 501 5122 or Google Radio Pro London. B-Cure Laser. B-Cure Laser.
The station that makes you feel good.
I recently did a story for the Times, New York Times, about children with autism in nature. So apparently, you know, children with autism often have trouble communicating with other human beings or picking up on social signals. But the good news is that they're really tuned in when they get into the natural world. I mean, more so than maybe even other kids, precisely because they're so used to going inside. You know, they're not like very often, they're not very social. I mean, they're different types of autism, and there's a big range and spectrum. But they find that being in nature, being with animals, is incredibly healing for kids with autism. Healing in the sense of not like their condition is a disease that needs to be cured, but just in the sense of allowing them to relax and feel a part of something, because often there's a strong sense of not being connected and not being a part. But I think that sort of speaks to the rest of us too, because even though we may be socially functioning people, but still in many cases we don't feel deeply connected, sometimes not deeply connected to other people, and a lot of people, you know, lonely these days, loneliness is increasing, but also not deeply connected to the natural world, which I think is connected to loneliness. It's a kind of loneliness when you don't commune with the elements, the sky and trees and rivers, forests. I mean, here in New York City, so I mean, you know, I'm overlooking the Hudson River right now, and it's a great blessing that even living on Manhattan Island, which I think is one of the most densely populated places in the world, that I do my work with a view of the Hudson and like New Jersey, which is the next state over. I can probably see several hundred square miles from this window. I'm on the 31st floor. And so I see the clouds. I watch the weather come in. I see the snow. You know, I mean, it's such a lifesaver for me to have even that kind of contact with nature, which a lot of New Yorkers don't have. I mean, if you live in an apartment on a lower floor, you may only see the street. I actually saw a kettle of hawks the other day. Do you know what a kettle of hawks is, Yara?
Hawks, as in the bird hawk.
Right.
Wow.
So a kettle of hawks is not just a hawk. A kettle of hawks is a rare phenomena which happens I think it happens all over the world, but it's kind of, even bird watchers haven't always seen one. And it's where hawks, which are usually a solitary bird, join together, and they're in a spiral. They're in this huge spiral. Sometimes there's 40 or 50 hawks all together, spiraling around each other. And what's happening, you know, you can say technically, is that they're in a thermal. So thermals are these swirling vortexes of air, basically, that are created by sunlight. And so the technical explanation is they're getting caught in this, and they're actually in migration. For some reason, this only happens during hawk migration, which happens when they're going south, which they are now in the New York area. They're heading south. And when they're heading north, which happens in the spring. So what I saw is, like, must have been about 40 hawks just spiraling around each other.
Wow. Over the like Hudson. A real life wildlife documentary.
Yeah. I mean, who knows that in just a few hundred yards off the off the bank of the Hudson River and in the most populated city in North America, there'd be this wonderful natural phenomenon. I think that even in cities, if we know where to look, we can find nature and be inspired by that.
That's just it, Richard. And I love the fact that you brought up the importance of outdoor and environmental education with young people. And you yourself, you've worked in the outdoor industry. That's predominantly what I do at the moment. And I love seeing the transformation that occurs in young people and adults too. It's like they've come from a different world, and it's a world, you know, the world is made up of what we see. What we're seeing every day, that becomes our reality. But I think it's highly important we keep that balance, right, between the modern and the natural world. Because to me, the natural world is the real world, you know, and it is important that young people have connection, have experiences in the real world. And Richard, you know, bringing up young people on the spectrum as well, I mean, it's scientifically proven, isn't it, that your brain behaves better in an outdoor environment. You know, there are specific neurons in your brain that only connect when you tune your human senses to a natural environment. And, you know, that's what's really funny, Richard, is I work as a forest bathing practitioner, right? So this is taking people to trees and woodlands for mental health and well-being. And I always feel really, you know, funny getting paid for this. Like, I almost find it ironic that we live in a world today where I'm guiding people into the forest and reminding them how important it is to be still, you know, coming from that fast-paced life. And it's like we've forgotten, you know, we've forgotten how to just be still and connect with the trees. And you mentioned it as well, young people, they're surrounded by lots of gadgets these days and technology. Like, it's not like when we were growing up, you know, things have really changed. And I'm seeing a lot of young people these days suffering with mental health issues. And I feel it has got a lot to do with nature deprivation. If young people are growing up, you know, they're encouraged to sit down a lot of the time, you know, they're sitting down in front of screens, and we need to get more outdoor environmental education in national curriculums, I would say. How important do you feel it is we incorporate more outdoor and environmental education in national educational systems, Richard?
Well, absolutely. I mean, in the US, we don't really so much have a national education system. It's more each locality and each state sort of does its own thing. But as far as getting it into the education system, I mean, I think it's so important that we all get exposed to it and educated in nature. Because again, I mean, the bottom line, sorry to be like a broken record, but it's like, if we don't love the world, we won't protect it. But beyond that, we won't be happy. I mean, that's sort of the most fundamental level. I know that as a child, so I grew up in New York, but I was always nature boy, and I always loved to get out of the city. And I was fortunate, you know, in our family, we would go up to the coast in New England, Rhode Island, every year, And I would have 2 months just to explore with my buddy up there, the salt marshes, and catch garter snakes and go clamming. And just that kind of freedom in the natural world was so, so important to me growing up. And now I notice a lot of parents don't like to let their kids sort of go off on their own. I understand there can be safety concerns, but it's like the ways that we used to get exposed as kids to nature, just kind of wandering free, I think it's becoming less common. So I mean, absolutely what you said about introducing it into the education system, I think it just needs to be part of the education system. It's just as simple as that. And kids learn better outdoors. And as a teacher, I was working often with inner city kids who would be in a classroom. The discipline problem would be huge. It's like you'd be disciplining kids and half the time, and they basically would want to be anywhere but in the classroom. So, you know, I mean, it's kind of like a police job in many cases. And I'm not saying all, you know, a lot of teachers have learned how to master that, but I'm not too good at discipline. But what I found is that even with these inner city kids who would be problems in the classroom, it's like it was no problem at all outdoors, because it's like they were at ease, I was at ease, they were discovering something that they didn't know about, so they were genuinely curious in a way that a lot of education is sort of forced down our throats. This doesn't come out of genuine curiosity, but I'll tell you, outdoor education, the things that kids learn outdoors is because of their own curiosity. Kids are, when you take them outdoors, they've got all sorts of questions about how trees live and, you know, why it rains and on and on and on. So it's like just as an educational opportunity, it's tremendous. So I totally agree with you. I mean, I don't see enough of it. And I think that some of the trends have been in the wrong direction toward teaching more for tests, like standardized tests in math or reading or whatever, and cutting budgets and things like arts education or outdoor education, things that I think are so critical for human happiness and development. So I'm not saying things are all good, but I'm so happy to hear that you're doing it, and there are opportunities for sure. And hopefully this will blossom in the future.
Richard, I think the woodlands are the best classroom. Nature is just an amazing teacher and healer, and I feel we need it in our lives now more than ever. Somewhere down everyone's ancestry is a tribal culture. You know, I'm not saying we all need to go back and live primitive ways. I mean, totally do that if you want to. I could do it myself, but you know, it's about finding that balance, isn't it, between this world and that world, and more sustainable initiatives. Like, I studied international development at university, and honestly, I'm still waiting for climate promises from 25 years ago to take form. And now there's all these new promises that have been made, and it's like we don't, you know, it's just a lot of stalling. I feel there's a lot of stalling going on, and power to the people. You know, I see a lot of positive change coming from the people on the ground and communities coming together to create more sustainable projects. And we want to hear more about that. You know, in a way, that's why the Environment and Conservation Show was born, to help raise awareness on these wonderful, you know, reforestation, rewilding, permaculture. Like, I'd love to hear more about these topics. And respect to you, Richard, for being an environmental journalist, raising awareness on these topics, because we really need more. There's a lot of fear bombarded in our face these days that can have a toll.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of also like positive things that are happening, I'm working on a story now for the Washington Post about the overall topic is deforestation for the production of meat. So meat is very agriculturally intensive to produce. If you're, you know, like beef, cattle need a lot of land to pasture in. Chickens, pigs, and other animals, they need soybeans and other vegetable foods to fatten, you know, so that they can be slaughtered for meat. And when you look at the number of calories that, like, you grow a chicken, let's say, and you're feeding it all its life with soy and other vegetable foods, So if that if those soybeans and other vegetable foods were used, let's say, for human consumption rather than for producing the chickens, they would feed a lot more people. And beef is, of all the meats, beef is probably the most intensive in terms of the amount of land that's needed, the amount of resources that are needed, and also addition of carbon in the atmosphere and greenhouse gases. I mean, cows produce a lot of methane, which is something like 100 times more potent greenhouse gas than even carbon dioxide. So from many different perspectives, meat production is not ecologically healthy to have too much meat production. It doesn't mean that we can't have any, but it's just like we're too focused in that direction. And so one of the places that's been most badly impacted is, as you know, because you spent time in the Amazon rainforest, is the Amazon. I mean, the Amazon is undergoing very high levels of deforestation, and a lot of it's for cattle pasture. Some of it's for soybeans, but basically, if you look at it, it's like the majority of the deforestation happening in the Amazon is for meat production. So the question is, what can we do about this? So there is good news as consumers. Well, first of all, we can stop eating as much meat. I mean, that's a long discussion that we don't really need to go into. I'm not saying everyone should become a vegetarian, but certainly we should be aware that this is it's kind of a luxury product and we should limit its use. But beyond that, we certainly don't want to be eating meat that's produced from rainforest cleared land. And that's what's happening in the Amazon, and it's happening in other places as well. So there's a movement, and it's actually stronger in Europe than it is in the US at the moment, which is getting consumers to basically tell the big supermarkets, we are not going to buy any products that are created through the destruction of the rainforest. And because of the pressure, I mean, I don't know if you saw, but there was a TV ad campaign, it may have also been on the internet, that showed like a fork spearing a jaguar. And it said something like, you know, next time you eat your chicken, you're actually spearing a jaguar, because it's like to produce that chicken, you need to clear the rainforest. And there's actually, somebody did a study, and in the last few years, thousands of jaguars have lost their habitat just for producing, you know, chickens. And so there's this movement, which was quite successful, I think, in the UK and I think in other places in Europe, and now several big supermarket chains. Is Tesco, is that a big, Tesco is a British chain that agreed, at least on paper, not to sell any rainforest-produced meat. And Carrefour, which I think is a French supermarket, made a similar pledge. Now, of course, companies can make pledges, and you have to kind of keep them to their pledges. That's not always easy. But just the fact that already these big corporations are feeling the need to make these commitments, I think is encouraging. And in I interviewed a fellow who's been working on reforming the salmon industry in Norway. So a lot of the salmon that we eat is farm salmon, and farm salmon is fed with soybeans, meal that's produced with soybeans. So he's been working with the Norwegian salmon industry to prohibit the use of rainforest produced soybeans in the production of salmon. And it's been successful. The salmon industry has transformed, which is a big industry. I mean, they send their salmon all over the world, and it's a multi-billion dollar industry. So that's kind of a big deal that some of these industries are beginning to commit to not producing their product off the rainforest. So it's a long struggle. And
I think with that, Richard, yeah, it's down to campaigning, isn't it? Because I remember signing the petition or the campaign to encourage these supermarkets to not sell meat that has come from rainforest destruction. So a lot of it is coming from small grassroots that are pressuring these big companies and corporations too. Because, you know, when you look at our whole economic system, a lot of it is based on profit and economic development. And I feel like a lot of environmental policies or and they get pushed to the side. Have you ever heard of the Gaia theory, Richard, that the Earth is a living organism, like a living self-correcting organism?
Right, right. Well, I put a lot of stock in that. I think that, you know, it's like Suzanne Simard, who thought that trees were conscious, right? You know, I mean, they don't look intelligent, and yet they remember, they feed others, they communicate about insect threats. They're all these things that make us now realize that trees are actually intelligent. They have consciousness. So if trees and people and animals, if we have consciousness, why not this amazingly complex and intertwined and integrated system, which is the Earth? I mean, why isn't that also conscious and alive? Now, I think it would be a hard thing to prove scientifically, but sometimes we make discoveries through other ways than through scientific research. And I think that people who are tuned into a kind of a global consciousness of the Earth it's something real. But it's something that science may take a while to understand how this vast intelligence is working. But we certainly feel that, and we already can see how intelligent and how interactive the natural systems are, which suggests that there is indeed an intelligence and a consciousness behind it.
You know, Richard, as an outdoor instructor, I feel that the whole, I will do, you know, fish gutting or rabbit gutting, and I don't personally eat too much meat. I'd say I'm a flexitarian, but during these lessons, a lot of powerful learnings come through, because a lot of young people, they've lost sense as to where their food is coming from, you know, that whole journey of it. You know, I once had a young person didn't know where bacon came from. I've had young people pick up an acorn and ask me if it's a pine cone. You know, like there's this disconnection, and that's what outdoor education brings. It reminds you of like where your food has come from and to be conscious of it. You know, when I told him that bacon comes from pigs, he was like, well, I like pigs. I was like, well, don't eat them then. You know, it's like, and with the whole rainforest, I mean, it's different perceptions, isn't it? Because the whole economic system perceives the rainforest as a commodity, you know, whereas on another perception, it's an ancient, irreplaceable habitat with much undiscovered biodiversity. You know, I hear that we've only explored 1% of rainforest canopies, and most of our medicine comes from rainforest. Imagine what else is up there. So it's almost like a battle of different philosophies going on. I mean, how do you feel as an environmental journalist? You know, there's a lot of words popping up now that haven't popped up before, words such as eco-anxiety and eco-depression. I mean, as an environmental journalist, how can we encourage more young people to tune in to this world besides outdoor education?
Well, I certainly think what you're doing and what journalists are doing is part of that, like informing young people and others about what's out there.
It's a tough question, Richard. Yeah, I'm sorry to kind of put you on the spot. It's like no one has the answers, you know? It's
like, yeah. I mean, the
difficult subjects that we're all facing with. I mean, we're all connected, aren't we? And this Zoom tool is connecting us, but we could talk about politics from now until the end of time. But I feel that when Mother Earth speaks, we will all listen, won't we?
I think that's happening in a way already. I mean, you talked about some things, just spontaneous grassroots things that are happening. People are moving on the environment on their own, apart from governments. And I think that young people, you know, a lot of young people are waking up to the emptiness of like being on the screen all the time and feeling a need for something deeper. So I think there's a natural cycle in these things that we may lose contact with the natural world, and a whole generation may seem to lose contact for a while. But then I think that that's that will turn around eventually, because there's this huge hunger within the human spirit to connect with the world. And I think there's, you know, the things that you're talking about, things that I'm talking about, there are like the early signs of this, these little good things that are beginning to happen. So, yeah, I mean, about the larger question of like, what can we do? Well, I think part of it is just to see that there's a certain unfoldment already happening that we can take part in, that we can join with other like-minded people and work on these projects. As you said before, I mean, it doesn't look like it's going to come from the governments. I mean, we just saw the big global meeting at Glasgow, and there were some commitments, you know, kind of very weak commitments, and governments usually don't even keep those weak commitments. So it's like, there's not a lot to be encouraged about at that level. It's almost as if it really has to come from the grassroots. It has to come from people.
I really believe in the power of people and the power of community. And I think you just hit the nail on the head there, Richard. We almost have to look at ourselves like the trees and the fungal networks. You know, I think we could learn from the way forests work. Like, we've all been led to believe that it's about survival of the fittest, but really it's about community. It's about network. And within Indigenous philosophy, they perceive, they will look at weaving. When you just have one strand, it might not be so strong. But then when you weave that strand with others and it becomes a network, it becomes stronger. And that, I feel, is a big lesson that comes from the natural world. Because for you and for I and for many listeners and people who are highly connected with nature and the natural world, I mean, even if you're not conscious of it, we are eternally connected to the natural world. So what's going on with these environments, it will affect you. For sure. And these words like eco-anxiety and, you know, these words that young people are dealing with. But you said it, Richard, there are amazing projects going on out there and things for them to get involved with. Might not see it much on the mainstream, but it is still happening. And I feel that when you ask the right questions, you will find it. If you want to work with wildlife, you know, go and connect with reservations and places where they work with wildlife. You know, you just follow your passion as you did, and it will lead you to where we need to go. And I think it's so important that we all tune into the natural world in our own different ways. You know, every act can have a ripple, and you've created some amazing ripples in your lifetime, Richard.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Galar Light is the quantum energy emitted from the universe, from the sun and stars. Now, Tom Palladino, a humanitarian and Scalar Light researcher, has created the world's only Scalar Light healing system, a system that can bring long-distance healing and wellness to humans, pets, and plants via a photograph. Get your free 15-day trial now at scalarlight.com or click on the Scalar Light banner on the UK Health Radio website.
Shields like masks are top of mind right now, but did you know you have inner armor working constantly to protect you from pathogens? It keeps you healthy and thriving. It's your immune system. Ion Gut triggers the body's natural ability to support gut strength all year long, so your immune system can protect you when you need it the most. How are you treating your inner armor? Visit uk.ionbiome.com to learn more. Ion Gut. Protect what protects you.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
You're listening to the Environment and Conservation Show on UK Health Radio.
I've written two spiritual books, one about Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, was a very famous holy figure in India in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And I wrote his biography. And I also wrote a book about my spiritual teacher in India. And I've written a poetry book. I love writing nature poetry, as I think you do too. So that's available. Anyone who's interested in nature poetry and want to take a look, it's published by Salmon Poetry, and it's called What the Dust Doesn't Know. It's a book of basically nature poems. So I'm definitely writing. I continue to write poems, and I have in the back of my mind some larger book ideas, but nothing has congealed yet.
Would you be willing to share some of your poetry on the show, Richard? It would be an absolute honor to have you share some of your creative work, please.
Well, thank you. So the title is Swallows. How from the doldrums of the day they tumbled, only swallows skimming treetops. Yet no wheeling eagle could compete with this squall of sickle wings, roller coasters sprung from nowhere, going nowhere fast, or conjured from the air itself, pouring in from everywhere like rain. No ordered flock, but schools of comets spinning tails of flame, arsonists lighting the sodden woodlands of myself halfway through an August afternoon. They did not stay to fan the fire. So I sprouted wings of words and joined them, keen to learn what flying means, not dragging wings through air as geese do, pumping steady over oceans, nor like those snow-white flappers, egrets, wending on the sky's black river, and nothing like the owl I saw today slide deathly mute through mazy pines. These masters lack what swallows effortly effuse, not skill nor grace, but thrill and simmer, flying exclamation points, banking and swerving like dervishes, like shards of light, bouncing off the trampoline of air, as if flight were not a flapping habit, but a dizzy calling, less a way of moving than of falling constantly into astonishment, then catching themselves midair and winging off to join the wheeling flock.
Thank you, Richard.
That was Swallows. And what lies in store for all of us? Let's just put it that way. And anyway, readers, listeners can interpret it as they like, but many people have told me they've been inspired by this. After the opera, the curtain parts one last time, and the ones who killed and were killed, who loved inordinately, who went berserk, were flayed alive, descended to Hades, raged, wept, schemed, victims and victimizers alike, smile and nod and graciously bow. So glad it's finally over, they stride off suddenly a bit ridiculous in their overwrought costumes, and the crowd, still dark like God behind the footlights of the world, rises to its feet and roars like the sea. Maybe there's hope. There's hope for everything. Hope for us and hope for nature. I think there's a higher consciousness at work here that people are waking up. In that consciousness that we all share, that's beginning to awaken, that's beginning to move in society and in human hearts. That's my basis for optimism. Not in the Glasgow summit, not in, a lot of the news that we've been hearing, but in the human spirit. That, just to end, maybe, I mean, that's also what Jane Goodall told me, is that that's one of the things that gives her hope, is the human spirit, is that, even though things may not be going in the direction we want now, that there's always something in the spirit that's ready to be reborn and to come back, and in nature as well.
That's a really lovely message to end with. There is always hope. And so thank you so much, Richard, for coming on to the Environment and Conservation Show and for sharing your knowledge and your life journey. Is there any other positive messages you wish to share?
We kind of started by saying that we're not separate from the natural world. There isn't no such thing as the environment. We are it, I mean, we're part of it. And I think that that's something that, if there's a positive message to share, it would be like, plan to go out in the woods soon and experience this yourself, and bring a kid with you, because it's like, yeah, tell them, okay, put your cell phone down. And we're going to have a different kind of experience now. And yeah, bring a child into nature.
Good man, Richard. I love that message. Go to the woods, put your phone down, go to the woods, take a kid with you. That is a brilliant message. Thank you so much. That was an interview with environmental journalist, poet and author Richard Schiffman, who is based in New York. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Environment and Conservation Show. If you would like to connect with myself, please email me at contact@wildeyeadventures.com or touch base on socials. Look for Wild Eye Adventures. You're listening to the Environment and Conservation Show on UK Health Radio. We are always interested in interviewing more guests for the show. Please do connect. Wishing you a positive rest of the week. Tune into Yaz's show next time. Thank you so much. Take care of yourselves.